Welcome to you all. My name is John Lundblad. I'm finishing up on teaching staff here. I've been here for the last 3 weeks with my family. We're packing up today, leaving tomorrow, and then slowly throughout next week getting ourselves back to our home in Jerusalem, where I've been serving for the last 5 years. I'm officially known as the English-speaking pastor at Church of the Redeemer, which is a German Protestant church in the middle of the Old City. The British who come by say that that's a slander and a slight, that I'm really the American-speaking pastor at Church of the Redeemer. We've been serving there. Part of my work is with an expatriate congregation, that is, people who are living and working there for shorter or longer periods of time. As expatriates, part of my work is with visitors and tourists and pilgrims and wanderers and students and the rest. And then part of my work is in ecumenical and interfaith work as well. What we want to do today is continue some discussion we've had throughout this week about mission work today, and especially how we understand some of the overseas mission, not just within the specific tasks of church work, but of Christian workers generally, and of workers overseas who happen to be Christians. This has been something of a missions week for us here with a variety of people and a variety of topics. So those of you who have been here throughout the week have recognized that we have had other presentations on specific works of mission, a form on the whether mission is obsolete or not, other concerns specifically about the Middle East. There's another one this afternoon that is going to be about life on an Israeli kibbutz. Today we want to talk about the styles of mission and some of the problems. What I'd like to do by that is to present five styles of mission, five styles of the way the church is working overseas today, and elaborate on each one of those by a specific example. The blackboards having disappeared, we'll have to do it all orally. First of all, just to begin with, how many of you have ever spent any time overseas? First of all, how many just to travel? Just traveling overseas. Okay, so a good number of people have spent time outside of the continental United States. How about people, has anyone worked overseas? Spent time overseas? What were you doing? Tanzania. In fact, we're going to be, one of my examples is of Tanzania. So maybe you can help at that point. Anybody else? Yeah.
I was looking
for some people. Okay. Anybody else? By this, I don't just mean church work. I mean any kind of work at all overseas. Anybody else? Okay. First style of evangelism is, both historically and in the primary concern of the church, that of evangelism, or sometimes called evangelization. That is the proclaiming of the good news of Jesus Christ and the calling of other people to faith in Jesus. That was, of course, the major impetus for all world mission work, beginning from the time of Pentecost onwards. The disciples going out, Paul going out, the early missionaries going first out of the what we now know as the Middle East toward the rest of the Roman Empire, then by the year 500 getting up into the wilds of Gaul. By the year 1000, my pagan Viking ancestors were beginning to be converted, although they resisted and killed a number of missionaries until about the year 1100. Took another 400 years for the gospel to begin to get to the shores of North America, first with English and Spanish colonies on the east coast, and then especially with Spanish colonies and the missions on the west coast. By the year 1800, the gospel had gotten to the wilds of Oregon and Washington. And middle of the last century, we're beginning to talk about the gospel almost throughout all of North America. But it really wasn't until the middle of this century, about the year 1950, that it could really begin about the gospel being established in every land. And that was the task of evangelism, that is, of proclaiming the gospel. That is a declining concern. Not for priority's sake, but because there comes a time when you finally realize that the gospel has been planted everywhere. In other words, when you have so much of a garden and you keep planting it bit by bit, eventually you come to the end of the garden. It doesn't mean that the whole world has been converted. It doesn't mean that all people have come to faith. It doesn't mean that even a majority of the people have come to faith. But what we have come to is a time when the church or mission exists in every continent, in every land, among every people, and in every language. The work of translation is increasingly dealing not with major languages, but with minor dialects. Not with the great languages of the world, but with some languages or dialects or tribal languages that may serve less than 1,000 or less than 500 people. I know of one translation project that is dealing with a language really spoken by 300 people. So the gospel has been established. So by and large, that work is coming to an end, that of sharing the gospel and saying that from a new time, thank you, a new time is coming when the people of each individual country will take on that primary work of sharing the gospel in their own land. Even as we say, the primary task of continuing evangelism in the United States belongs to the Church of the United States, or the primary task for continuing evangelism in Sweden belongs to the Church in Sweden. There can be help and assistance from outside, but by and large, we would say that task increasingly moves from the foreign worker to the national worker. Doesn't mean we've come to an end. I would like to give one example of what the American Lutheran Church is doing among the Fulani people in West Africa. The Fulani are a nomadic tribe. They're Arab and Berber in background, Berber being the traditional peoples of North Africa. They use primarily Arabic, but it's a North African Arabic. They are nominally Muslim, but like the majority of Bedouin and nomadic people, they have seldom had any strong religious attachment. Beginning over the last 10 years, the American Lutheran Church and some European mission societies have established a work of what's called primary evangelism among these Fulani people, which means a work of radio broadcast, because the transistor radio has become the new means of communication throughout the world. Bible studies of visiting places, tied in with development projects and some nation-building projects as well. Primary evangelism is long-term work. It goes slow. There's a history of people who worked in parts of Africa and Asia who could work for 20 years and number the baptisms at maybe one a year. It's slow work, it's not always what we would call successful, it's long-term work. But it's a commitment to say, not that we have to gauge our success by how many people show up at church to be baptized. That's not the goal of any mission. The simple goal is not to convince people to become Christians, but simply to tell the story. Because very much within our Lutheran theology particularly, the work of faith is that work of the Holy Spirit. We do not convert people. That is the work of the Holy Spirit. All we ever do is share the story and let people hear. Letting people hear in a way that it can be understood. So, first task, primary evangelism. But as the early missionaries went out, especially beginning about 150 years ago, they found that they could, that there were a lot of them. And so that early work of individual evangelism gradually developed into partnership work. What we call the modern ecumenical movement began really in mission work. It's when groups would get together and begin to say, well, we're all in one area. You know, 10 different mission groups in one area and nobody else is anywhere else. There was a great deal of sharing, a great deal of cooperation, and a great willingness basically to say, we will work in this area, you will work in that area, someone else will be in another area. This came about for two reasons. One, they all had a common goal, that of sharing the gospel. Secondly, because the majority of them, out of Protestant and even out of many Roman Catholic mission orders, had a similar theology and a similar understanding of the Bible. There was a missionary understanding that transcended a lot of denominational barriers. And that was much of the origin of the ecumenical movement. But as the evangelism proceeded, as the work developed, eventually there was the beginnings of a national church. And especially since World War II, what we have seen is the elimination of mission fields. We simply don't have them anymore. That, as a term, disappeared from the American Lutheran Church in America, and Lutheran Church Missouri Synod well over a decade, in most cases over 20 years ago. We simply don't use that term anymore. And if you're accustomed to using it, you should just as well forget it. There are no more mission fields in the sense of mission organizations running churches. What we have instead are indigenous national churches with indigenous leadership, often with foreign workers as part of them, but they are self-directing to an extent. Many of them are becoming self-supporting, and they're basically self-guiding. So that when foreign workers go, for example, to the Japan Evangelical Lutheran Church or the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Tanzania, it means that they are not working simply for the Lutheran Church in America or the American Lutheran Church, but increasingly they are working for the national church. Do you want to say something about how you operated in Tanzania? What your work was and who you worked for. And yeah, which means that mission organizations don't exist anymore. People work for the national church, and increasingly then the mission agencies who once were instrumental in establishing the churches, like in Tanzania, the Church of Sweden, the predecessors to both the Lutheran Church in America and the American Lutheran Church, German workers and others. Basically, when the church came into existence, they discontinued their mission organization. The missionaries began working for the national church, and the mission agencies then, instead of directing the affairs, began process of negotiation in partnership. How best can two groups work together towards some common goals? But
one other thing on that too.
Yeah.
Particularly, I think Tanzania may be a little bit unique in the situation.
Yeah, it is.
In that there are so many national churches involved in mission work. Right? There's the American Lutheran churches, and then there's all the German Lutheran churches or the Scandinavian ones. And they had initially had each of these various country churches had their own mission field initially. But like during the time that we were there, and of course it's been evolving, because of the work through the national church in Tanzania, they would send out a call if they needed to fill a position. And so it may be filled by someone from Norway or someone from Germany or someone from the U.S. and stuff. And we're working, you know, from the people from overseas, the missionaries that were filling these positions. We weren't just working at all Americans or all Germans, as well, of course, as the Tanzanians. Sure. We're working with people from other countries as well, which made it much more international kind of a scene as far as the administration and working at the church.
Here. This has happened, it's also begun developing in Japan and elsewhere, where the mission agencies who have a continuing concern, in effect, form an ecumenical organization that then becomes a sole mission body, so that the national church does not have to negotiate with all the individual churches. But all of them have involvement and concern and have moved into this partnership style. The partnership has also developed a work of, as I mentioned before, of a true ecumenical cooperation in some parts of the world. And the example I'd like to use would be the United Mission to Nepal. Nepal, for those of you who've forgotten geography, is the country kind of around Mount Everest. It's thus on the border of the People's Republic of China. For many years, it was a nation that was closed to most outsiders, and especially to foreigners, or to foreign missionary workers. But as Nepal made some changes within themselves and began to move on the process of what's called nation building, they did put out a call to a mission organization that had been working on the borders but outside in a medical work, basically saying, we would like you to come in to do medical work purely, medical work and national development. That group, fortunately, decided that the opportunity was too great to be limited to one individual group, so they immediately established a group called the United Mission to Nepal and extended invitations to other missionary bodies who were represented in the area, saying anybody who would like to join in this ecumenical mission, which did not include evangelism. The Nepalese government specifically said that it was for medical work, development work, nation building, but not for specific evangelistic work, could join. And so we had the development of what's called the United Mission to Nepal, which now involves some 38 different mission organizations, North American and European, all of whom contribute to an annual budget, all of whom contribute personnel and operations. They have to commit themselves to an ecumenical operation. They have to commit themselves to basically abiding by the style of work that all of them develop and abiding by the terms of a specific development and nation-building kind of program. The work has developed, and they're extremely good representatives with our relationships with the Nepalese government. There have been some groups that have wanted to come in and do what's called undercover evangelism. In this case, the ecumenical group itself has said no. We cannot risk the positive work that is being done for the sake of some high publicity work that people like to do. There is a Christian church in Nepal, and it is growing and developing. And this kind of work of development or nation building is itself a continuation of evangelism. Because what happened as the early missionaries went out, none of them went out to be doctors or teachers or road builders or anything else. All of them went out to work in individual evangelistic work. But simply by where they were, they became involved in partnership with other groups, in ecumenical operations, and as they looked around at the situations in which they lived, they simply could not limit themselves to what would be called traditional evangelistic work. They ended up building schools, and building hospitals, and building clinics, and building programs, and getting involved in nation-building work. That work continues, and it's probably been as much a witness to the concern and love of the gospel as any specific preaching has been. So the work of development has long been regarded as another primary work of mission. It is not regarded as simply another way to get people to hear the gospel. In other words, schools are not built to get people in to teach them religion. Clinics and hospitals are not built to get people inside so that a preacher can go around and preach to them in the ward. Schools are built so that people can be educated. Hospitals are built so that people can be cured. Roads are built so that people can get agriculture to markets. Wells are dug so that people can have water. It's done for its own purpose and not for what we would sometimes assume are ulterior motives. That in itself has been as much of witness to the gospel we have as anything else, that the concern is really for helping people. There's been a change in that now, especially over the last 20 years. The post-war period, as nations have developed, there has long been this concern as to how these groups shall work with nations and how all these institutions shall work as nations develop their own programs. That is, as a nation develops a school system, should the church continue to operate schools? As a nation develops its own medical programs, should the church continue to operate its own medical system? And increasingly, the churches are saying, not really. If the task was to simply develop an educational program, then when the state can begin doing it, then it is better in many cases simply to turn the whole program over to the state. In some cases, this has been done, where the church has given schools to the state or given hospitals. In some cases, they've been nationalized. In other cases, they the church has simply said it's no longer our business to run schools or hospitals when the state can do it. In many cases, this has freed up the church to move into other areas. This has not always been done there. We still have one of the major problems of old institutions that have often been turned over to the new churches. Who retains continuing responsibility for these old institutions that often demand a lot of money, or often get fairly expensive? Who retains responsibility for them in terms of continuing maintenance, continuing operations, continuing work? But this work of development and nation building has been continued by groups like Lutheran World Service, and the group I'd like specifically to talk about is the Mennonite Central Committee. How many of you have ever heard of them? MCC. For a small church of well less than a million people in North America, they're probably one of the most effective overseas mission and development organizations that I've ever run across. They have a major work on the West Bank, the area we're from, of simple little things like agricultural programs and olive seedling planting and grape arbor developing. It's always done on a contract basis with a village, like a water project. It's never simply done for people come in. It's always done on a negotiation. People always have to put in a certain amount of money themselves, and where there is labor involved, the village always must contribute the labor involved. So it is not simply a charitable project. It is working together with people in saying, we have certain resources and certain skills, you have certain needs, how can we best put the needs and skills together in terms of the development of an individual village or an individual agricultural area? When you look at it on little case basis, it's not a whole lot. But the goal is never to remake a whole nation. The goal is to help individual areas. The goal is always to do projects that other people can see and say, yes, there are new things that can be done, new ways of operating. That's another part of the church work, of doing the pioneer projects, the witness projects of saying this is a new way of doing something. Moving, for example, as MCC does a lot, from traditional ditch irrigation to drip irrigation, especially in areas of low water resources, and what that would mean. Those of you who have ever seen drip irrigation projects know that it uses less water, more crops, less labor involved because you don't have as much of a weeding problem, and is a more effective growing system. It's been an effective means of introducing that into agricultural areas. So, development, nation building. The fifth work that the church has moved in has been one of what we can really call assertive action. This is a work is sometimes especially we connect with the World Council of Churches in certain areas, or with the Lutheran World Federation in the Namibia question, or the Roman Catholic Church in some of the Latin America questions. But it's where the church recognizes that there is something wrong in the system. Not just that it's not working quite right, but that it needs repair, or that it needs new technology, as in development work, but where there is a quantity of racism in the system, where there is a quantity of economic imperialism, of leftover colonialism, of injustice, of unrighteousness, and where the church in the area, since it has become involved in the people in development work, in partnership work, in working together and worshiping together, that the church will often take stands on a local level, a national level, or moving to an international level as well, to draw attention to problems. The probably most current example for most of us as Lutherans is the Namibia question. The majority of people in Namibia, Southwest Africa, currently still under a South African rule, are Christian, the majority of the Christians and the majority of the people in the country are Lutherans, belonging to something called the Ovambo-Kavango Lutheran Church. And Lutheran World Federation and Lutheran churches around the world have basically united themselves with this Lutheran church toward the freedom of that country, which the United Nations has said it is entitled to. So in that sense, it has been assertive action in a social and political realm. This is not real common. The church has not become extensively involved in this in many areas. Another area would be the church's work, or the Roman Catholic Church's work in a country like Poland now, of trying to deal with the social and political problems within a country. We don't consider that mission work, except that there is a point where the church, because of its operation in a country and with people of a nation, that it's bound to take certain social and political stances. So all of these works are still going on, and most church bodies are involved in these, not in every individual country, but in different ways. So we cannot talk about the Lutheran Church in America, or the American Lutheran Church, or Methodist Board of World Ministries, or any of the rest, as being involved in every country doing all of these things. There are really nine nations that the Lutheran Church in America has historic relationships with. The Lutheran or the American Lutheran Church matches some of those, but then it has some different ones. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod has yet other ones, depending on the particular historic background. In some areas, the Lutheran Church in America is involved in evangelism. Some areas were involved in partnership or ecumenical work, as in Tanzania or in Japan. In some areas, like through Lutheran World Service in Ethiopia, we're involved not directly with the national church, but in development projects. So what we're seeing now is not a single understanding of mission everywhere, but a variety of understandings in a variety of, worked out in a variety of ways, depending upon local needs, local concerns, and the direction of the local church. So what we have is this wide sense of variety around the world. There are, of course, problems. I'd like to share a couple of problems and then open it up for time of questions and comments and reflections on your part. There are, of course, since World War II, the development of nationalism. And then, of course, how do we as foreigners work with the national church in one of the new countries of the world? Like Tanzania, like post-war Japan. We're basically foreigners who are working with a national church which has connections with the government of that individual nation. We particularly who come from the United States as foreign church workers have difficulty sometimes with people who do not make a distinction between our task as working for the church and our political background as citizens of the United States. There are changes in relationship, so that it's not a mission church and a mission board. Those changes in relationships do not always happen easily, nor is it always easy for Western-trained people to come into a church that is increasingly developing its own style and its own African or Asian or Latin America style of operation, and those two do not always mix easily and well. So there are that problem of dealing with the new church and the new nations. There are the problems, as I mentioned before, of institutions. As churches turn over institutions to the new national church, the national church does not always have the available funds to continue operating these or to continue the development tasks that have always been connected with the overseas mission body. One example I know from our area, there is a school, a girls' school, established by German deaconesses in the last century called Talitha Kumi. The local church would like to take it over. It's one of the very few remaining Lutheran background churches that has not gone under the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Jordan, but it costs about $1 million a year to operate. And less than half of that money comes from fees and local income. There are two Lutheran church bodies in Germany that have over the last 100 years regularly supported that school. Up until the present time, they've put in close to 250,000 Deutschmarks, about $125,000 to $150,000 every year toward the support of that school. Those church bodies in Germany have basically said, as long as it remains a German institution, we will support it. If it becomes a national institution, that is, if it's turned over to the Arab Church, they will no longer support it. So it's a problem. The local church wants it but is not able to operate it. The foreigners who support it basically want to retain it as a foreign-supported and directed institution, even though that rapidly is disappearing as a style. But if it's turned over, it would probably have to close. Increasingly, that problem of the wealth of the West and how it's to be shared with the churches in the developing countries, or how to deal with all these old institutions. Who retains support responsibility, and can there be support responsibility, that is, giving money, without program responsibility as well? In other words, are we willing simply to give $100,000 a year to support a school and basically leave all program direction in the hands of the local church? A third concern that is increasingly developing, we see it in the church in China as it has begun to emerge again, is what is called the three self movements: self-direction, self-support, and self-determined, where we're moving even beyond the level of partnership to a style of inter-church relationships, which means that we have individual indigenous churches that have no direct connections with one another, a national church that directs its own affairs and remains self-supporting, not needing help from outside, either in money or personnel. So we are developing a third level of trying to understand what it means really to share, to give as well as to receive, to trade people. A national pastor from the United States going to work in, say, Japan for a year, and a national pastor from Japan coming to take his place in the United States for a year. That's a new level for us, that we're not simply the giving church, but moving to a receiving church. And we're not quite able to make that development, that break yet. We're still learning what it means to receive when we've always had the image of ourselves as the giving church. I've talked up to this point primarily about church work, but I'd like to take 5 more minutes and talk about Christian work overseas. Church work is one way that Christians operate overseas. That is, all these things we've talked about are one way. What did I do with my napkin? There it is. Church work is simply one way of operating, of Christians being able to work overseas. And we often think, we often limit ourselves too much to these particular styles. And that's why the subtitle for this presentation includes those terms of opportunities for service. Because if we talk about Christians working, we immediately think, first of all, of church work. But I want to say that there are other opportunities as well. The first one, or the another one, is representatives. People who are involved in international business. People who are involved in living and working overseas for a period of time. Professors on sabbatical. Teachers in an international school, someone from International Harvester or Boeing or IBM or how many different companies we know that have people living and working overseas, not just in Europe, but in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Now, their primary task, being overseas, is doing work. Person is systems manager for Boeing in Seattle. He becomes a systems manager for Boeing in London, or Dar es Salaam, or Rio de Janeiro, or Tokyo, or somewhere else. Doing basically the same work. But the person remains a Christian and can become involved in the life of the church in the country, normally going to an English language church, but that person, as that person works with the local people, the Japanese, the Tanzanians, the Argentines, the British, wherever it is, there is the same opportunity for witness, the same opportunity for service that would exist in the United States, of talking to friends and neighbors and co-workers and the like, as questions come up about faith, about life, about dealing with problems, probably increasingly overseas, of dealing with people, expatriates living there who are difficulties in adjusting to life overseas, nationals of a country who have very limited experience with Christians and might never go inside a church, or might never talk to a professional religious like myself, would be willing many times to ask and share with an expatriate. Just as we might spend time in Japan learning something of Shintoism, or in India learning something of Buddhism and Hinduism, or in Egypt learning something about Islam, or in Tel Aviv learning something about Judaism, there is that opportunity for sharing. And I don't think we're aware of the great value and the great importance that can be done by the simple witness of people who are living and working overseas, living out their Christian faith even as they would in their own home country. So one style is as representatives. Another one, for which you don't even have to go overseas, is again this idea of affirmative action. That when we are living and working here in the United States and coming to be aware, as we've talked often up here at Holden, about the concerns of injustice, the concerns of racism, the concerns of sexism, the concerns of economic disparity, all of these around the world, we can throw up our hands in despair and say it's not worth it, nothing can be done. But we can also say that there are some few things that can be done. Which can begin simply by letting political leaders of our own nation aware of how we happen to feel. That's why, if you've noticed in on the bulletin board in the dining hall, one of the things that is posted there is simply a complete list of all the congressmen and senators of all the states, or all the people in Congress, so that someone up here who wants an opportunity to write a representative about some concern that's developed here can do so. That's part of affirmative action. We may think about it as political concerns, or social concerns, or economic concerns, but they grow out of our Christian faith. And if we happen, because of our understanding from our Christian background, if we disagree with the policy of our country, or if we happen to disagree with the direction we feel our country is taking with an individual nation, if we disagree, for example, with the apartheid system in South Africa and feel that our country should be speaking more strongly about that, if we feel that our country is not showing enough concern for minorities in various parts of the world, if we feel that our country is not spending the foreign aid money that we have wisely enough, then part of our work as Christians becomes that affirmative action, which are those simple tasks of writing letters, of letting people know how we happen to feel, or of sharing our thoughts with other people, of if we pick up some understanding from some reading we do, from a study group we're part of, that we can share it with people who make statements that we feel are uninformed. That's part of the affirmative action, which has always been part of mission work, whether it's in a local nation or around the world. Another area is that of the translator. Now, I don't mean by that one who does language skills. Not one who is going to work and in turn unknown language into a written language and then be able to translate the scripture. I mean by that a social translator. I'd like to use the example of two young women who happen to be working up here at Holden, Marlis and Sue. Marlis works in the as a waitress and Sue works down in Narnia. They'll be leaving here next week, going back to Minnesota, and on September 11th they will be commissioned as ensigns in the United States Navy, serving for 2 years as two or 3 years as nurses. I talked to them about this, so it's they know I tell people about it. If you had been up here 2 weeks ago during the time of the arrival of the Ohio submarine, the first of the Trident class of submarines in Seattle, and those of you who remember reading about it, remember the controversy, the so-called blockade, the extensive discussion that went on concerning this as another step in accelerating the nuclear arms race. By and large, we'd have to say that the majority of staff people up at Holden were on the side of or in favor of those who were making a witness against nuclear arms. And that meant in that particular case of making a witness against a naval operation, part of the United States Navy into which these two young women are going to be serving for the next 3 years. But I would also say that they serve a valid and important part, apart from their work, apart from questions about serving in the armed forces, which I do not have problems with, or the value of nurses, which I'm very glad we happen to have around the world, but this work of translating. Because they're in a unique position of being in the middle and being able to share things back and forth. So that people within the naval structure who might make comments about wild-eyed radicals who don't understand the world situation, they can explain the sincerity and depth of faith of those people who are seeking to understand how to work for peace in the world. On the other hand, for people who may have never met a naval person in their life, they can also explain that the captain or the commander of the Trident submarine is not a bloodthirsty pirate. He's a family man, has kids, doesn't beat his wife, goes home, pays his taxes, and has troubles with his bills and everything else. It's that sense of translating. And at times I feel the concerned Christian has that as one of the most important roles we can, of simply being able to share and explain in non-threatening ways what two different sides are trying to say, or sometimes in radical situations, shout at each other across a canyon. One person once used an analogy of two people on different, two groups of people on different sides of a canyon. And they were trying to get a message back and forth, and they couldn't shout because it was too far and the wind blew their message away. And so they tried to they had paper and they tried to sail planes across and they couldn't do anything. Finally, one of them got the bright idea, what we'll do is write the message on a rock, okay? And we'll throw the rock across. So what happens? They throw the rock across and what happens? Hit somebody. What's the immediate reaction? Those people are trying to kill us here. The message is forgotten because of the method of presentation. And what the translator becomes is simply not the one who can share the information from one side to another. And that, I think, increasingly becomes a role of the Christian in mission, of doing that task of translator, which is something that can be done by all people. We've come to 11:30. We close at 11:45 for those of you who want to get up to a first lunch. Let's spend the last 10 to 12 minutes in any questions or comments or concerns or other questions or other thoughts you might have. Anybody at all? Yeah.
On your second one, representatives, is there any control by our government or otherwise as to the kind of people these are?
No.
I just happen to know of two
absolutely
families
not.
That are over there that I'm not too proud of.
No, in that sense, it's part of our free market economy that the government has no control over who a company will send overseas. Mm-hmm. Within certain limitations, the United States government can refuse to issue a passport to someone, but that is very rarely done, extremely rare. That usually is only done in cases where the person is not, they do not want the person to leave the country for legal purposes. If Also, while the person is overseas, under the Privacy Act that was passed some years ago by Congress, the overseas representatives, embassies and consulates, cannot become involved in the affairs of individual American citizens or families or operations unless it is brought to their attention by the host government. So that the United States government, in effect, has no specific interest in Americans living overseas unless the host government brings the concern to light or the individual walks into the consulate or embassy requesting help, or if the person is ends up in a hospital or in jail. But the consuls and ambassadors cannot be aggressive in their concern for Americans. So that how people are selected to go overseas depends completely upon the individual company. Some companies have a high degree of concern, others don't. Now, the individual nations do control it sometimes by the visas that they grant. And they can revoke visas if they feel that a person is not proper for the country. But other than that, no. There's no control by our government on that. Yeah.
I'm interested in this translating that you mentioned as the last function.
Yeah.
Having been here a month and having seen lots of rocks lying on both sides of the canyons, even around here, where the atmosphere is fairly open and people are fairly approachable with new ideas and so forth, there still are these little skirmishes.
Yeah.
So I guess I feel that is a difficult job and that there probably are some skills to learn in doing that. And are you saying that is there any place where that is emphasized as a function of our Christian missionary?
I think it's properly a function in parish ministry, increasingly. And this is something I've come to living overseas. I don't know how, in effect, it could be done, except by some action on the part of a pastor with people who he might know of in that kind of position. I do agree. I think it's a very difficult position because the person who tries to do that is inevitably going to be living in an area of some tension. Like, you know, the two young women going to be, they are naval officers and trying to, and I think in that then it needs to be a person working within an organization who has some concerns and connections outside. But I think that's where a parish pastor or someone else, seeing someone in that position, can help sensitize people to those skills, because I think they have to learn non-threatening discourse and non-argumentative kinds of styles. Because it's not to convince anybody to change their mind. It's simply to share and help people eliminate misconceptions. I think, for example, business people within the church have the same kind of opportunity, especially those who might be involved in international business, of trying to do this translation between modern business and economics and social ethics personnel. Because by and large, the majority of religious leaders know very little about, especially macroeconomics, you know, and the new world of economics. We just don't have that training. But also we have a lot of people who are very skilled in economics who don't always know, or not always sensitive to the concerns that they hear from the social ethics side. And so I think in both cases, someone working in business who can do the sharing back and forth offers the same kind of opportunity. Very, very carefully. I think at this point, the churches who traditionally had any work in China are proceeding very, very cautiously. One, because they will not do anything except at the invitation of the national church, what's now called the Three Self Movement, but which is the Christian Church of China. They would not do anything except at the invitation of that church and, in effect, the approval of the government. And everybody's just kind of waiting. I think what we're going to see is much more, not so much the church work, but this representative kind of work. the sensitive Christian who might be going in business or industry, who will simply worship with in a local situation and come to know some local people, but not seeing himself as anyway an undercover evangelist. I think there's a lot of talk about, you know, smuggling Bibles and undercover evangelism, and the risk involved in that simply doesn't outweigh the positives. Partly because China is now working on publishing or printing and publishing a new Chinese version of the Bible. A new version by that using the new Chinese, the simplified Chinese that is now common to the newspaper and not the old Chinese. In effect, they're coming out with a revised standard version instead of using the old King James. So I think that the church is just proceeding very slow and very cautiously. Also because there's a certain amount of humility. Because everybody assumed, not everybody, a lot of people assumed that in 1948, when Mao Zedong was victorious and the nationalist forces went off to Taiwan, and for 30 years we just didn't hear anything at all. And there were just no news. Occasionally bits and pieces, but by and large everybody assumed that if the church survived, it was simply the old people who were gradually dying off. And to suddenly find out that the church is still there and developing and not growing rapidly, but that it is an indigenous, independent church, is something humbling. That at this point they really don't need anything from us. If they think we can give them something and share something with them, I think everybody will respond positively.